This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And we have an exciting show lined up for you today. And we're going to kind of delve into something everybody's talking about, and that is the heat, the change in climate. Why are things getting so hot out there? This week, I had the pleasure of participating in a lecture at UConn for athletic trainers, and specifically I was talking about head injury, but one of the speakers there was Dr. Robert Huggins. Rob is a professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UConn, and he spoke about heat-related illnesses. He's involved with the Corey Stringer Institute that we've spoken about before on the program. And it was an outstanding lecture that he gave that I felt had a lot of helpful information for all of us that extended outside of the field of sports in terms of how our bodies work, how our bodies cool, and the importance of really being mindful of heat-related illness. And we're hearing so much about it at this time. You heard just on the news a few minutes before on how we're seeing it more globally. There are people visiting Greece, Sicily, Italy, all over the Mediterranean, who are falling victim to heat-related illnesses. Probably one of the biggest ones right now is what's going on in Saudi Arabia, where Muslims make a pilgrimage to Mecca. And they try to do that at least once in their lifetime. So many, many people are coming to Mecca, and when they get there, they have to make a rotation. They walk quite a bit to go to various shrines. And the temperatures there have been 108 up to 120 as they're doing this. Now, you have to understand, many of these people have saved their entire lives, so they're older people who are putting their bodies through this stress. And it's believed 452 deaths, so just there, have been attributed to heat-related illness. We're seeing it in Indonesia, 199 cases, in India, another 98. And don't forget, these are countries where people are acclimated to warm weather. So it's not like that they came down from Alaska or some cooler temperature. So one of their problems has been not enough cooling stations, not enough water supply. So it's really a disaster from that standpoint. What continues to puzzle me is the people who are denying that there is climate change, right? I mean, these are people who are out there speaking. Actually, sadly, some of them have been elected to office. This is science. It's pretty basic. All you have to do is look outside. All you have to do is look at temperatures. They're going up. And we're going to be encountering this more and more. And it is clearly a global problem. It's not just an American problem that has to be addressed. I mean, we even have in the state of Florida, you can't write about climate change. You can't use the term climate change. And yet Florida is probably one of the most vulnerable, if not the most vulnerable state when it comes to climate change, not just with heat, but flooding and things such as that. The other thing is FEMA, the federal organization that deals with federal emergency managements, they don't recognize heat as a disaster. They also don't recognize fires as a disaster when it comes to these brush fires. So when we look at this, we have to really rethink how this is going to work and how we're going to put resources in to try and remain cool. not just with air conditioning, but what are we doing globally to protect the entire planet and not just our own country and people taking this kind of nationalistic view toward it. This is a huge, huge problem. We're experiencing it here, as we're going to talk with Dr. Huggins about a little bit later on. This day in medicine is June 22nd, 1874. And we talk a little bit about Dr. Andrew Taylor Still. Now, Dr. Still was born in 1828. He died in 1917. And he was a self-taught medical practitioner and became the founder of osteopathy on this date in 1874. Osteopathy was something that we knew very little about here in the East. It was something we mostly saw in the Midwest maybe 50, 60 years ago. And you'll see this with doctors who have initials after their name that are DO rather than MD. And that means they attended a school of osteopathic medicine. Over time, the two fields of medicine have merged to a great degree from the standpoint that osteopathic physicians do the same type of residency as medical doctors. They, have to take the same type of exams. The big difference is that in some osteopaths practice manipulation. So similar to chiropractic manipulation, you call this osteopathic manipulative techniques, or OMT. And so that's really the biggest difference when you see someone who has DO after their name. But as I mentioned, it was something you saw a great deal out in the West and in the Midwest more than you saw it on the East Coast. But now, with the real need for physicians, we're seeing a lot more who, and it's really kind of merged together pretty nicely. Something else, a lot of people right now, everybody's planning vacations, planning, you've got to get from here to there, you've got hotels and things like that. And imagine doing that when a member of your family has a neurologic problem, especially a child, an autistic child, a child with ADHD, or any of what we call now neurodivergence. So where you're not incapacitated, but have some special needs. And in the wrong situation, it could lead to a real problem and ruin a vacation. So now what we have are, there are hotels, there are travel agencies that cater to people who have some neurodivergent needs. And it's kind of important when you have a child, you're trying to go to Disney, they're not tolerating loud sounds. They try to find the right hotel in the right situation. So I was very happy to see that because I deal with a lot of folks who have different neurologic problems that they have to deal with. And especially in children, when you have multiple children and you're trying to cater to everybody's needs. So just imagine how hard that is. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest today, Dr. Robert Huggins, and we're going to be talking about heat-related illnesses. If you wish to reach out to me with questions for Dr. Huggins, he'll be with us he'll go right till the end of the show with us, because this is a big topic, and I think there's so much information that we need to get from him as we plan our days through this heat dome, as they call it. And so if you need to reach out to me, you can go to info@alessimd.com and just reach out if you have a question for him, and I'll pose it to him. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it's great to have as my guest, Dr. Robert Huggins. Dr. Huggins is a professor in the Department of Kinesiology. He's also the president for research, athletic performance, and safety at the Corey Stringer Institute at the University of Connecticut. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Alessi. How are you today?
All right, pretty good. So, Rob, let's get some background here on the Corey Stringer Institute for the people who don't understand what that is and how important the work is that you folks are doing over there at UConn.
Yeah, so Corey Stringer was an offensive lineman for the Minnesota Vikings. He was a Pro Bowl lineman, and he unfortunately back in 2000 suffered a heat stroke during the second day of the preseason training camp in Minnesota. The day before, Corey was on the front page of the newspaper, bent over, vomiting on the center in the center of the field. So it was unseasonably hot that day, and there was actually a heat wave that was occurring. And Corey was a very large individual, as you can imagine, some of these NFL guys. And he was struggling on the first day, likely had a heat illness the very first day, and then the second day, he had a heat stroke, and it was not recognized promptly. It was not treated promptly, and he died as a result of his heat stroke. As a result of the heat stroke, there was a lawsuit that occurred. His wife and their agent had secured someone from the University of Connecticut named Dr. Douglas Casa to serve as an expert witness in Corey Stringer's case against the NFL, the Minnesota Vikings, and Rydell, who was an equipment manufacturer at the time. And one of the things after the lawsuit, they obviously had won that suit, but the NFL had said, you know what, we don't want this to ever happen again in any player, regardless of whether it's football or not. And Dr. Casa and Kelsey Stringer and James Gould came together and said, how about we start the Corey Stringer Institute? So it was founded back in 2010, and KSI has been around for about 14 years now, and we have been serving the public. So we promote advocacy and education and research in the areas of preventing sudden death in sport, but also maximizing physical activity in athletes and soldiers and laborers now. Quite a bit of work we're doing is in the laborer division, and we've been doing that for about 14 years. So we're really proud of what we do and trying to keep people safe.
Rob, you know, one of the things, I guess, when I first heard about Corey Stringer and other athletes, and I just say, how the heck does that happen? I mean, it's the NFL, all right? We've got every piece of equipment out there. We've got athletic trainers. We've got so many levels of medical personnel, and yet you still hear about this. Where's the touch point here? Where's the weak point in this whole process that allows an athlete in this day and age to die of a heat-related illness in an organized workout setting?
I don't think we can pinpoint one thing with heat stroke. Heat stroke is, a perfect storm, if you will, of multiple things going wrong at the same time. There are things that we can do to prevent the heat stroke in the first place, and then there's treatments that are extremely effective if done promptly and aggressively. Really, it's a holistic approach to safety. We know when athletes suffer heat stroke. We know how it occurs. And athletic trainers, if you're in a high school and you have one, which we know that there's about 13,000 high schools in this country that have athletic training services, and about 7,000 do not. If you have an AT that is there, able to help intervene and watch out for the safety of these athletes, and especially at the highest level, they all had athletic trainers. And since Corey's death, Dr. Casa educates and does live calls with all 32 NFL teams, reminding their athletic trainers, reminding their sports medicine docs and their staff, this is what heat stroke looks like. This is when it's most likely to happen. Here's how you prevent it, and here's how you treat it.
How big a problem is it? Not just in sports. I mean, I talked a little bit at the beginning of the show about people going to Mecca and 450 people dying from heat-related illness. I mean, the numbers clearly are going up. But can you frame the problem for us a little bit?
Yes. Yeah, so, on average in the high school and collegiate setting, we see about 20 deaths per five-year block. So in the last, 30 or 40 years, especially in the 2012 to about 2010 to 2015 year block, we saw some of the highest numbers of heat stroke that we had seen in a long time. And unfortunately, they continue to happen. And most often it's when policies and best practices are not followed. We have things called wet bulb globe temperature devices, which is a small handheld device that really measures the amount of heat stress that the human body is being exposed to on a given field or on a day, right? And we use flags like the military does to essentially have proper work to rest ratios, the type of equipment they should be wearing, that how long the breaks should be, the access to fluids, like all of these things matter when it comes to heat stroke prevention. You need to have someone, though, that's there to make sure that this happens. And most times it's a medical professional in form of an athletic trainer in the sports setting.
And, one of the things that you talked about in your talk was really the fact that that at some point in the next several months, you're going to get a call, okay? You're going to get the call that some athlete died from this. That just blew me away. When we talk about, the numbers that you went over. That call is going to come sooner or later, and you just start trying to figure out how do you stop that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, heat stroke in the months of July and August is the leading cause of sudden death in sport. Cardiac is the leading cause of death, 10 out of 12 of the months of the year, and is the thing that we need to be most prepared for. We all saw Damar Hamlin. That happens once every 5 days, if you can believe that there's a cardiac arrest. And many, unfortunately, don't survive that. But heat stroke, like I said, in the summer, is the leading cause. And we will get a call from a parent, from a coach, from a physician, someone who interacted or was there that day, asking us more information about how and why their child passed. And it is extremely difficult. You can imagine that phone call that comes to you saying, I'm such and such as parent. My son is either in the hospital or daughter's in the hospital, and they've passed. And I saw information on your website, and I wanted to know more about how this happens and why it happened. And we will then, console, obviously, but also ask about the scenario, ask about the conditions. And there are reasons why things go wrong and why these athletes die. If we don't have proper recognition at the time of the injury, we can, including a body temperature. Exertional heat stroke is when we have a body temperature greater than 104 degrees and we have mental status, alterations and dysfunctions. It can manifest in a lot of different ways, and people often don't always recognize it very quickly. Think about someone who's inebriated. Think about someone who's concussed. Think about people just not acting themselves. They could be agitated. They could be dizzy, nauseous, vomiting, but uncoordinated movements, stumbling. All of these things are what it looks like. That's what heat stroke looks like. And you have to promptly recognize and treat it. And unfortunately, for most medical professionals, the first heat stroke that they experience is the first one that they're going to need to treat. And it's really tough and hard to see. But when you do identify it with prompt core body temperature measurement, and unfortunately, we don't have the technology right now to be able to get an accurate measure of core body temperature unless we take a temperature rectally. And medical professionals are trained to do so. EMS in many states, including the state of Connecticut, are required to take a temperature. And then this is the kicker. You have to treat immediately. You have to cool first and transport second. That person needs to be...
I'm going to have to hold you. We have a hard stop, they're telling me. So I want to get into all of this and the immediate treatment. But right now they're telling me we got a hard stop, got to go pay some bills, and then we're going to come right back. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and today I'm joined by our guest, Dr. Robert Huggins. Dr. Huggins is a professor of kinesiology at the University of Connecticut, and we're talking about heat-related illness. Rob, before I had to cut you short there, one of the things you mentioned I thought was key, not only now but in your lecture, was the idea of cooling a person first before EMS gets there. And not just in sports, but I think in everything. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that's so important?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we have a heat stroke, essentially our organs are cooking inside of us, and proteins are denaturing, and so many horrible things, cascades are happening of inflammation. And one way to, or the best way really, to cool someone is to put them in an ice bath, you know, a tub, an agricultural stock tank, a kiddie pool, you know, some sort of vessel with ice and water. And while stirring that water aggressively, you can really bring someone's body temperature down quickly. The amount of time that a person spends above, you know, 105 degrees, that threshold for cell damage, the worse the long-term injury may be for that individual. So it's critical that you cool on site at the spot where heat stroke is first identified. And you might be in different situations where you need to get them indoors, put them in a shower, find a freezer and put ice towels over the entire surface of the body. You know, ice packs do not cool an individual. Actually, passive cooling, just being outside and trying to cool passively is a worse cooling rate than that. So, you know, I know some EMTs and others are taught to do those things, but unfortunately, they will not result in a cooling rate that preserves those cells and saves someone. So if you're with someone that's experiencing a heat stroke, you know, call 911, cool the person as fast and as rapidly as possible. Hopefully when they arrive, they will take a temperature, but allow that person to continue to cool. Taking them out of the thing, the tub or the shower or the thing that is probably saving their life is probably one of the worst things that can be done, because they don't have the capabilities in the ER to be able to get ice, water, and cool an individual. They don't have these things. So you think about it, as bad as that sounds, it's just like CPR. You got to push hard and push fast and treat right away.
One of the slides you put up were the things that work best and the things that work worst. And you already said that about passive. But, you know, we always say, well, just hydrate. But it's almost like you're past that point when you start getting into heat-related illness. Am I correct in thinking that way?
Yes. You can actually be 100% hydrated and still suffer a heat stroke. It's all about how hard the engine is working, how much heat that engine is producing, and that engine is your body. It's the muscles. So if you are producing a whole bunch of heat and you can't dissipate it, you can't get rid of that heat via sweating, you can't get rid of that heat via, you know, airflow and convection. If you're not doing that, your body is going to gain heat faster than it's losing it. And what happens is if we get above 104, 105, it happens at different temperatures and different individuals, depending on what temp, you know, how used, you know, how acclimatized you are and how useful or how, you know, commonly you get your temperature up to those conditions. But yeah, you can ultimately, you know, overheat the engine and heat stroke will ensue. And often it strikes without people even knowing. You know, they could, 1 minute they said, yeah, I remember I was running at mile 8. And then I went black, and I don't remember anything after that. And I woke up in your cold tub, and they have no recollection of anything that happened to them.
You know, one of the things I also found fascinating from your talk was the fact that after you get them cooled down, then you have to rewarm them and, you know, take patients out, wrap them in Mylar blankets and put them in the sun, which is something I didn't really think about. Can you explain that logic?
Yes, absolutely. So when someone gets a heat stroke and we're bringing their core temperature down from, you know, the highest I've ever seen is 112, believe it or not. But bringing someone from, you know, more commonly we see 106 to 108. When you bring someone from those temperatures down to 103, which is when we would probably pull them from the tub, they continue to have what we call after drop. So their temperature will continue to drop precipitously, and sometimes it even gets below 98. It might even go down to 95 or so, which is fine. We're preserving the cells, and we've gotten them out of the danger zone there. But then we need to rewarm them because essentially the hypothalamus, there's a transient, you know, paralysis, if you will, dysfunction of the hypothalamus, which is the temperature regulatory center in the brain. And what happens is that the person, it just goes into a state of dysfunction and can't rewarm as well. The person isn't even shivering sometimes, despite being down at those temperatures. So we actually have to physically dry them off, wrap them in blankets, remove their wet clothing that they've just been in with the tub, and get them out in the sun and get them warm again. It's really ironic.
How much does acclimating make a difference? I mean, so we're hearing about these folks in Saudi Arabia who are passing out and dying from heat-related illness, but you would think to some degree, obviously, they're acclimated to those temperatures. And I think we recently saw that we discussed the fact that our baseball team went down to play in Florida for the Super Regionals because they weren't acclimated to that. So how much of a factor is being acclimated to the temperature play in this and avoiding heat illness?
Being acclimated is critical. We call it heat ACC for short in the lab and in sports medicine. And, you know, there's a heat ACC is a term that is essentially defined as the physiological adaptations that our body undergoes when we are actually exposed to heat appropriately over the course of, you know, 7 to 10 days is about the amount that we recommend, but there are changes that will still occur all the way up to day 21. These adaptations include reduction in heart rate, increase in plasma volume, so that fluid portion of the blood that's being pushed around to our body. And why that's important is because when we're exercising and our body needs blood to be distributed to the skin to help us cool, to the muscles to help us exercise, and we have to maintain our cardiac output, our blood pressure and our heat rate. So when you heat acclimatize, you will see your heart rate is lower than it would be in the same conditions a few days later. Our core body temperature will be at resting will be lower. Our efficiency of sweating will be higher, so we'll dissipate that heat better. So when you have these adaptations and you induce them over a 10 to 14 day period, you will see massive changes that are performance enhancing. Honestly, it's almost like legal blood doping. If you've heard about the blood doping epidemics, like plasma volume is really important for our bodies to be able to distribute that blood. And then the hydration piece is coupled with it. So if you are adequately hydrated and you are heat acclimatized, you will perform the best during that activity relative to yourself if you are unacclimatized and dehydrated. So these are all protective things that our body is an amazing thing and can adapt to the stressors that we place on it. And that's a protective, you know, evolutionary mechanism.
Rob, I have a question from Marie. And have we made progress with respect to children dying of heat illness in cars? Obviously, these are tragedies we hear about all the time. But, you know, now we've become more aware. I know there's alarms in cars that go off and try to bring your attention to it. Have we made any progress in this? Is this something you've come up against?
I don't study what's called classical heat stroke. Most of our work focuses on exertional heat stroke. So exertional is related to exercise, and it's the body's muscles that are producing that heat. But for a child or an elderly individual who is not exercising, that's what we refer to as classical heat stroke. And, you know, unfortunately, these things are still happening. And I don't think that with climate change that they are going to reduce anytime soon. Until we come up with more devices, more things, more awareness around, you know, our elderly and our most fragile, you know, of infants and babies. Until we start changing that. And, you know, I remember a public service announcement that was like, always check your back seat. Right. I have two boys. And when they were younger, I was always thinking about that when it was hot. Oh, let me check the back seat. You know, and I think that we just have to have that thought and, you know, awareness and education, you know, shows like yours, being able to get out there and just remind people, especially at these times, because we all have busy lives. You know, we just have to protect our loved ones as best as we can.
Next question comes from Bob, and this one is related to clothing. So these various cooling garments, and I know you folks have done some work with the Mission folks there in terms of the clothing they design for cooling. How helpful is it?
Yeah, so the clothing can be a huge part of your ability to dissipate the heat. So if you have thick clothing on that is not breathable, not moisture wicking, what's going to happen is you're essentially smothering your body's most efficient way of getting the heat off of your body. That evaporation of the sweat off the surface of your skin is critical to your ability being able to cool. So folks who wear long sleeves and wear thicker cotton clothing, or, you know, there's a lot of workers out there wearing PPE, you know, personal protective equipment, gloves, safety jackets, steel-toed boots, and they have to wear certain things. It's definitely impacting their ability to be able to keep cool. So, you know, usually moisture-wicking clothing, light-colored clothing, loose fitting to allow for that airflow to get inside of between the boundary layer of the shirt and the surface of the skin. All of those things are going to enhance our ability to use our natural cooling mechanism, which is sweating.
So people should be wearing those, like if they're going out to play golf or going hiking, things like that. You would recommend that they really pay close attention to the type of clothing they're wearing.
Yes. I think it's critical. It's only going to help you feel better, and it can actually help, you know, keep your body temperature, you know, plateaued at, you know, 100 or 101, which is totally normal. It's normal to be out in the heat and have your body temperature between 99 and 102. If you're working out in the backyard or you're doing some strenuous activity, you can be at those temperatures. You just want to stay at those temperatures. You don't want to go above those. So, you know, wearing that clothing is definitely highly recommended. You know, avoid, you know, a lot of people will wear longer clothes, though, to protect from the rays of the sun as well. So I know they make a lot of loose fitting SPF, you know, shirts now. So I highly recommend the use of those, including, you know, products that you can wet and wring out and then activate that cooling mechanism. Mission Athlete Care makes the blue cooling towels that you've probably seen in Target and Walgreens and Dick's and other places. Those towels, you can actually soak them, wring them out, and then put them over your, you know, on your neck, or they make hats and shirts. They're activated by moisture, and they actually are very cool to the touch when you put them on your body. So all of those things can help with our thermal comfort and our perception, which will help you, you know, complete the round and maybe get that hole in one.
yeah, that'll help. lessons will help, but You know, you just gave me the perfect lead-in for the next question because Bonnie had a question here. And hers is, she and her daughter routinely run their temperatures at 95 to 96 degrees Fahrenheit. Anything above 99, they start to run a fever. How does that affect heat issues? So is there, I guess what we're asking, is there thermoregulation or their thermostats set differently? How does that work?
Yeah. So I mean, you probably need a little more context with their individual scenarios.
Sure.
And cases, but some people's resting body temperature is slightly elevated. And if it is slightly elevated on a regular basis, you should definitely consult your primary care physician. And it's not an advantage to be hotter when it's hot outside because you have less wiggle room to work with. So, you know, you can try to conduct heat acclimatization, which is the process we just talked about earlier, to try to get your body to adapt to higher body temperatures. There are devices that are out there to be able to put on your outside of your skin that can help give you a good estimate of where your temperature might be. One of them is the Calera, C-A-L-E-R-A. A research device that can strap onto your arm or to a heart rate strap, and it can kind of let you know your doses, your exposures to the heat, and that can be super informative. So I would recommend that to them if there's no other underlying medical conditions that they are aware of to look into that. Medications, stress, underlying illnesses, all of those things can ramp up our core body temperature in a way that could be limiting your capacity or your resilience in the heat. So make sure that you're addressing each of those factors as well.
Boy, we're getting a lot of questions. Margaret has a question here about when you're putting sunscreen on, especially on a child, and you know, a lot of times we recommend that they use something with zinc oxide or titanium oxide. Does that in any way prevent sweating or add to hyperthermia when you put these thicker lotions on?
Yeah, so there is some research to suggest that or that theorized that these heavier, thicker sunscreens could actually clog the pores and inhibit a person's ability to sweat. So there is some research to suggest that it inhibits it slightly. But it's like you have to decide, do I want burnt skin and maybe, you know, and the harmful rays of the sun on my skin, or do I want to prevent the heat illness? And sometimes it's hard to choose between both. If you do have to have your shirt off and you are out in the sun, then yes, you need that sunscreen on. Just know that you might want to pay a little bit closer attention to getting their fluids into the child and to taking breaks in the shade whenever possible, obviously getting in the water if that's an option. Obviously, if you're at the beach, this is why we flock to the beaches, is to keep our body temperatures down. So, you know, I would never sacrifice, my child's skin by not putting on the, you know, proper sunscreen. And obviously, there's a lot of different options there, but some of them are sweat resistant and will allow for sweating to still occur. Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think we need to look into it a little bit more in terms of the body's ability to thermoregulate, especially those who are exercising intensely.
I have a question, because in sitting with your lecture, I see, you know, you guys do a lot at this Falmouth Road Race, right?
And yes.
When is the Falmouth Road Race?
The Falmouth Road Race is the third Sunday in August up in Falmouth, Massachusetts on Cape Cod. It's okay. A 7.5-mile road race. Right along the surf drive, right along the lighthouse is there, it's a hot one.
Okay, so, I mean, it's like having your own lab. I mean, you folks are over there dunking people. You got tanks everywhere. You're rewarming people. You have rectal thermometers going in. Why don't they just move the date of the race, okay? I'm sitting there saying, my God, this is like mass carnage at this thing.
You bring up a great point. I can tell you historically, the race used to start at 11 o'clock, I believe, or noon, which was even more oppressive, right? Since then, it's come all the way back to about 8 or 9 o'clock start time. Unfortunately, our humidity usually is highest in the morning. So while we don't have like the highest radiant heat load from the sun and the temperature may have not climbed, we could still be dealing with really soupy conditions, especially by the water. And like I said, the more humidity that's in the air, that inhibits our ability to sweat. When the air is dry and cooler, it's going to be very accepting of that fluid and that sweat that's coming off my body. So, you know, I know that they have talked about this at Falmouth many, many years. And I think the fact that you know, not one person that has been treated in the last, my gosh, I think there's a separate publication, it might be 20 years, that has had a heat stroke has died from exertional heat stroke at the Falmouth Road Race because of the prompt recognition and the proper care that is there at those road races. What it does bring into question is, I want you to think about the races that you sign up for. You need to think about calling the races and saying, what medical provisions do you have here? And I'm not just talking about EMS. I'm talking about people who understand sports medicine, who understand exertional heat illness, who understand cardiac. I'm not saying that EMS doesn't, but they may not have the experience of what to do on site for someone, especially with exertional heat stroke. But yeah, you bring up a great point. You know, I think it's been a rite of passage for a lot of people in Massachusetts. It's been historic for years and years. They had their 50th, I think, anniversary of the running of the Falmouth Road Race. And I don't think we're going to stop people from doing it. So we might as well make sure that we have the proper medical care there because we know it's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I guess they haven't been sued yet. But anyhow, that's usually what changes things. Hey, Rob, listen, I want to thank you. Thank you for your time today. And thanks for everything you do personally, as well as all the folks over at the Corey Stringer Institute. Thanks again. I know you have a busy day ahead, and I really appreciate you taking time to spend with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Many thanks to Rob Huggins, our guest today. Many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board for us back at the studio. And if you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast by downloading it at Odyssey.com. If you have questions for me during the week, you could reach out at info@AlessiMD.com. Thanks to everybody who kind of emailed in during the show. It was great having questions from all our listeners. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.